you. That kind of fits right in with what I'm going to talk about at first. Welcome to everyone. We have some visitors, and that's wonderful. Thank you for coming down. This is nice here. It's a little bit closer for us. It's only about an hour away from our house. At this season of year, we obviously focus on being thankful. Gary mentioned that in the prayer, and we're going to be mentioning that today. But did you ever realize that the Bible also tells us not to be thankful? And by the way, I am going to do something with the children if they want to go ahead and come up and maybe get in the front there somewhere. Can you think of a scripture? Don't cheat now. If you saw what I was writing back here, don't answer. And I don't want an answer now anyway. But can you think of a scripture while we're going to be doing something with the children here that tells us, or where we're cautioned not to be thankful for something? Did you think there's a scripture about that? So just give that some thought. And while you're thinking about that, as the children come forward, I want to talk just a little bit about Thanksgiving in the Bible. Did you realize that Thanksgiving is in the Bible? And how many? Anybody think that Thanksgiving is in the Bible? You do? Or are you just because I have my hand up? Is it there? Why? Where? Where is it? Well, what is Thanksgiving? Yeah, okay. Okay. And it's a time when we give thanks to God for what we have. Absolutely. And what's the history of that? Where did it start, or where did it come from? Anybody know? Oh, you know, pilgrims. And who are they? They came to Massachusetts. And when was that? Anybody know the date? When did they come here? To America. Anybody know close? Was it Bible times? No, it was after that. So that kind of Thanksgiving isn't actually in the Bible in terms of the Plymouth Rock, which was about 21? So that was about 400 years ago. Okay. Did I do that right? Yeah. And the Bible was written, the last parts of the Bible were written almost 2,000 years ago. So, Thanksgiving might not be it's not exactly in the Bible. Certainly the principle of thanking God is in the Bible. It's all over the Bible for sure. But I would like to look at a scripture. And I'm going to turn to the book of Nehemiah. Nehemiah is a book that was written at a time when the Israelites were coming back to Jerusalem and they were rebuilding things and they were working hard at building their houses and temple and all kinds of things. And the people that were in charge were trying to put put things back together maybe a little bit the way they were, okay? And one of the things had to do with Thanksgiving. So let's read in Nehemiah 11 and verse 17. I'm going to read in the King James. It gives a list of some of these people here. And, got to get there first. 11 verse 17, I don't know which I said it the other way around. 11 and verse 17. It says that these different people were the principal to begin the thanksgiving in prayer. So there was something in this service that was called the thanksgiving, okay? It actually uses that word in English, the thanksgiving in prayer. And the second one was somebody else. So they had a first one and they had a second one. So these are people that had to do with the thanksgiving. Now, in chapter 12, in verse 8, it says, gives us the name of some of these Levites, and they were over the thanksgiving. Now, do you think that means that they were over, like, in charge of the turkey? Anybody think that? They wasn't in charge of the turkey. They were over something. They were in charge of something that was called thanksgiving at that time. And it had to do with, if we read verse 8 here, it was over the thanksgiving. Well, if you look in, anybody looking in a New American Standard? Anybody have, yeah, what's it say there? For chapter 12 and verse 8, I think it is. Nehemiah chapter 12 and verse 8. Where I just read Thanksgiving in the King James. In charge of the songs of Thanksgiving. So you see, Thanksgiving back at this time, in Nehemiah's time, was something that had to do with songs. had to do with music, okay? And if we could look at some other ones in chapter 12 and verse 27. Thank you for that reading there. It says they had cymbals, psalteries, and harps. They had instruments. They didn't have a trumpet. We have a trumpet. We got a piano. That's really nice. He can make that piano sound like anything. But they had instruments. So there was music going on, and this was called the Thanksgiving. Now, if we look at the Psalms, I just want to look at one Psalm. Let's say like Psalm 4. Okay? And what is a Psalm? There's a book in the Bible called Psalms. What are those Psalms? What are they? Any idea what those are? Yeah, they're books. They're chapters in the Bible. There's a lot of words. What kind of words were they? They were the words to what? Songs. Thank you. The Psalms, in English, P-S-A-L-M-S, were songs that were sung. And if I look at, like, say, Psalm 4, the fourth one, if you read the little print that's before the chapter, it says, David's praise for this and that. It says, to the chief musician. These songs were written to people who were the chief musician. Well, who was the chief musician? What does that mean? What? In charge. Who's the person that's in charge of musicians or in charge of a choir? It says, in the New American Standard again, it says, the choir director. The choir director. Anybody ever been in a choir? Anybody ever been a choir director? Okay. Well, we have, you know, all these psalms to be, there are songs that are sung, and they had a choir director or a conductor to conduct the instruments. And you said none of you have been a choir director. Now, I'd like you to stand up, and you've got to spread out a little bit, okay? You can spread out all over the place here. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to teach you a little bit about being a choir director, because I have been a choir director before. You want to learn to be a choir director? You've got to spread out, because you've got to spread your hands. So maybe you've got to get in two rows. Spread, go way over there. Yeah, you can get in two rows up front. Yeah, spread out a little bit, because you're going to be doing this with your hands. Now, if we sing a certain song, like one of the songs we sang, some of the songs we sang today, or one of them at least was this way, I'm going to teach you how to do one that is in what we call 3-4 time. All you have to do with your hands is make a triangle. Can everybody do that? Can you go down, over, and up? Draw a triangle. Try that. Down, everybody down. Everybody out. Everybody up. Down, out, up. You're just drawing a triangle. Down, out, up. Down, out, up. Do it in order now. Down, out, up. How long can you do that with that guitar? Down, out, up. Do it. Down, out, up. Down, out, up. Down, out, up. Down, out, up. And you thought being a choir director was hard, didn't you? All you got to do is draw triangles for some songs. Some songs you got to draw T's. We'll do that some other time. Draw triangles. So now you all know how to be a choir director. Down, out, up. Let's do it again. Make sure you got it. Down, out, up. Just draw triangles. One, two, three. One, two, three. Boom, pa, pa. One, two, three. You got it. You got it. All right. Now all you need is a choir, right? Think we can come up with a choir? How many of you in the sitting down there will volunteer to be a choir? We have any choir? All right. Now, you guys, now that you know how to do this, turn around. Come over here some. Some over here. Get plenty of room. Some of you on this side. If you don't mind, go ahead. Go to the right. All right. Turn around. Turn around, Justin. Turn around, Adam. And if you'd all... I'm sorry. You notice we didn't sing another song. I think there was a reason for that. If you'd all take your hymn books and turn to page 235. I think it's a umpapa. We gather together. We were going to sing that today anyway. So go ahead and stand, take your hymnals, please, and we're going to sing this, and you all can be the chief musicians. Now, we got a lot of chief musicians, but we got a lot of Indians, too. We got the chiefs and the Indians, so we're okay. And all you have to do in this song, and I'll kind of get in front of you a little bit here, or maybe I'll look at you a little bit. So all we have to do is keep doing this. All we have to do is keep making triangles, okay? All we have to do is make triangles. Boom, boom, Boom. Okay? That's all you got to do. You can look at me. You can look at the choir. You can do whatever you want, but we will make triangles. Okay. I'll tell you when to go down. There we go. We gather together to ask the Lord's blessing. Down, out, up. 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 Down, out. Down, out. Go right into the second verse. Up, down, out, 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 up, down. Thank you. Very good. Okay, you could go ahead and... Well, I guess you don't take your seats. You're going to go somewhere else. Somebody. Thank you very much. So we got some good practice there. You know, Justin, your dad's not getting any younger, so we need to practice. So, you know, when he's tired, gets too tired, doing, we can have somebody else lead songs, right? Catherine, where do you want them? That way. Okay. Thank you all very much. You can go... that away into the kitchen. You're not going there to eat, I hope. Somehow I got to keep everybody occupied while they're smelling turkey and mashed potatoes. They did pretty well. All right, anybody think of a scripture, not you who look behind you. Anybody think of a scripture where the Bible cautions us to not be thankful? I'm going to talk about the book of Luke just a little bit. In Luke chapter 1 and verse 1, Luke writes, Luke 1 and verse 1, he said, I've got the King James today. As many have, I should have brought my glasses up here, I think. As many have taken in hand to set forth in order a declaration of those things which are most surely believed among us, even as they delivered them unto us. So what's that telling you right there? Luke was not an eyewitness. Luke didn't have firsthand information of the information he was putting in the gospel. He did have firsthand information of many of the things he put in the book of Acts. Thank you. But he wasn't there to see the things that he put down in the Gospel of Luke. He had to rely on certain sources. He doesn't explain who they were or what. Even as they delivered them to us, which from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word, as it seemed good to me also, having had perfect understanding of all things from the very first, to write unto those in order, most excellent Theophilus, that you might know the certainty of those things wherein you have been instructed. So Luke took it upon himself, for whatever reason he had at the time, to write a history of the church, and I guess it didn't make a whole lot of sense to him to write a history of what happened in the book of Acts without explaining what led up to that. So he went ahead and wrote a gospel for this Theophilus and whatever audience it was intended for that gave the story of the Jesus who was the cause of the church that he gave the history of in the book of Acts. There may be different documents in the book of Luke, and one of the sections of the book of Luke is called the travel narrative, and it begins in Luke chapter 9 and verse 51. That's the popular name for it, the travel narrative. It's actually more, it would be more accurate to call it a Jerusalem document because he went to Jerusalem and that's where the things happened. It wasn't as if he was doing things all along the way. I mean, he was, but that's not what the recording, the account is about. It's about what happened when he was in Jerusalem. In Luke chapter 9, verse 51, it says, "It came to pass when the time was come that he should be received up, he steadfastly set his faith to go to Jerusalem." So he knew it was getting close to his time, to it's close to Passover when he was going to die, and he knew he was going to have to go to Jerusalem for that prophecy to be fulfilled, and for all the events that were going to take place before that. I wrote the wrong thing down here. In chapter 19, we can see the end of this particular section, this particular document that perhaps was one individual or specific document that Luke had access to that he included in his gospel. Luke chapter 19 and verse 47, it says, "He taught daily in the temple," talking about Jesus, "but the chief priests and the scribes and the chief of the people sought to destroy him, but they couldn't find out what they might do, for all the people were very attentive to hear him." And then it goes into some of the details at the very end. So the time in between chapter 9 and verse 51 and chapter 19 and verse 47 and 48, that time in between is called, popularly, if you look it up in some of the resources, it's called the travel narrative. I think more accurately it should be called a Jerusalem document or Jerusalem narrative. This is an account of the teachings that were in Jerusalem and in the temple leading up to the time of Jesus' death. There is an organization to these sections. It's interesting. I'm not going to go into that. The individual parables within this section also have an organization, a literary type. There were styles of writing. For whatever the reason, we have our style of writing now. They had their style of writing then. You're going to see a little bit of that just as I look at one particular one today. So the individual parables have a literary structure. And we need to understand, I think, and sometimes I know this is something I wasn't really made aware of earlier in my life, but that the Bible was not necessarily written in a way that we would write something today. Because we have our own mindset and our own way of doing things. We would write, if I were to write a story about what I did and where I go, it would read like a diary, all these details about what I did. And I'd be very exact about the order that certain things happened in. I don't think Luke was writing that way. Luke was writing a story decades after it happened to explain what Jesus did, what he taught, and how Christianity started. He wasn't trying to write a travelogue, say, this happened at 3 o'clock on this day, and this happened at 4:30 in the morning the next morning. Most of the time, he wasn't worried about those kinds of details. And the accounts have a literary style, which is interesting. Maybe it was to make it easier to remember, easier to tell, I don't know, or just the style that they wrote. And of course, Jesus taught. Sometimes we try to compare one gospel with another, and that's fine. It's instructive, but you got to realize that Jesus was teaching for 3 years or more, and he didn't give the same story the same exact way every time. Nobody does that. He tailored it to his audience, I'm sure. Certain accounts of how he told a particular parable became stuck in people's minds, or they were recorded or whatever, and they're the ones that came down to us. But I'm sure he didn't say everything exactly the same way every time he said it over the course of 3 years. So, with that little bit of background, obviously I'm going to be in this section of Luke, or I wouldn't have talked about it. What area of this section of Luke, where do we get a caution to not be thankful? I'm not going to use a projector, I was just hiding something. So I'll take this down if I can keep from tripping over it. All right, Luke chapter 18, beginning in verse 9. Luke 18 and verse 9. It says, Luke writes, that he spoke this parable unto certain which trusted in themselves and despised others. This isn't the only parable in this section that is intended for that same audience, but this is one of them. And here's how it goes in the King James. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a publican, which means, everybody know what a publican is? Tax collector, person who collects taxes. The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself, God, I thank you that I'm not as other men are, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even as this publican. I fast twice in the week. I give tithes of all I possess. And the publican, standing afar off, would not lift up so much as his eyes into heaven, but he smote upon his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. And Luke writes that Jesus said, I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone that exalts himself shall be abased, and he that humbles himself shall be exalted. Okay, that's how it reads in the King James. I'd like to spend the rest of the sermon time looking at this parable, see what we can gather from it. Verse 9 is an introduction. It may have been put in there by Luke, may have been put in there by the original source, so there's no way to know. But it's not part of the structure that I'm going to show you in just a minute. It says he spoke the parable to certain. He was actually addressing this to people who trusted in themselves because that they were righteous and they despised other people. Well, let's take a minute here, if you don't mind. And I'd like to look at the structure here. Do I need to put this up a little higher or down a little lower? I notice a difference when I'm over there. This isn't exactly quoted from the King James here. You notice I have, these are like stanzas. It's written in a sense of poetry a little bit. You have one stanza here, one stanza here, one stanza here. You have the center. Then it goes back. The reason it's written like that with these steps is because, and I think Dr. Johns gave a sermon some years ago about poetry, the way poetry is used in Hebrew. And I don't understand a whole lot about that or about how it was also used in Aramaic or Greek. But this is a form of, I guess poetry would be an accurate way to put it. It's a certain way of writing something. We got an expert here. Gary's going to correct me later. Anything you want to say, just raise your hand if I say something wrong, because I'm not an expert on this. I just want to get the points out of it. It's called parallelism. In other words, there's a relationship between this stanza here and the last one. That's why they are indented not at all. Then there's a relationship between this stanza and the next to the last. And there's a relationship between the third and the fifth. And then you have the center. Okay? And that's called parallelism. In this case, it's called inverted parallelism because the way it takes a turn in the middle. That's not important to know necessarily, but it will help us, I think, on occasion as we go through this, it will help us to understand a little bit more about the parable when we realize ahead of time, at the beginning, how it was written. And that helps, in my opinion anyway, and the opinion of many others, it helps us to get the point a little better. This is a deliberate construction. It was on purpose. The person who wrote this, and I would suggest that it's probably not Luke. Luke used a document that was already in existence. The person who wrote it this way on purpose. One, to make a point, maybe two, to make it easier to remember. And you'll see a lot of this in the New Testament, and certainly a lot of it in the Old Testament as well. In the introduction, there's no question. We don't have to read this and wonder what the point of it is. That's really handy. When the person who's going to tell you the story, or in this case, you know, whether Jesus said that, more likely it was the editor, whoever put this together, or Luke himself, when he assembled the whole book, he said, this is why Jesus gave this parable. He gave it because he was talking to people who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and they despised others. So we don't have to wonder what the main point is. It's given to us right at the beginning. Notice the beginning here. It says, two men went up to the temple to pray. What's the hint that there's some parallelism here? Look at the last stanza. They went down. In the beginning they go up, the end they go down. Okay? It's just one of those things. It's the way it was written. Why did it say they went up to the temple? Easy question. Why did they go up? It's on a hill. Pretty much everywhere you were, if you wanted to go to the temple, you had to go up. They went up to the temple. And when they left, they went down to their house or wherever they were going. There are two individuals that go up. There's a Pharisee and a tax collector, or a publican, as the King James puts it. Now, do we know anything about the Pharisees? Anybody just want to throw out some adjectives or some descriptions? Anybody? Everybody's afraid of me. Huh? Arrogant? Wow. You think they were all arrogant? Oh, okay. Maybe some of them were. Yeah, it seems like it. Yeah. I'm sorry? Some of them were definitely hypocrites. Jesus definitely said that. Yes. Extortioners. Oh. Boy, we're really hard on the Pharisees. Did they have any good points? Yeah, yeah. Okay, thank you. I didn't have that in my notes. That's a good point. It will tie in with the parable here. Now, can anybody say something positive about them? Oh, here we go. Paul was a Pharisee. To some people, that wouldn't be saying a positive thing, I guess, but you know, to some it would be. Thank you. They were zealous, absolutely. I mean, they were known for that. I'll just read from Acts 26, the first five verses. This is Paul talking, I think, to Agrippa. He had talked to Felix, Festus, different people, and he says to Agrippa, when he says, "You're permitted to speak for yourself." And Paul said, "I'm happy to talk to you because you're an expert in all these things, Jewish, and because I know." You know, that you will take the time to hear me patiently. Then verse 4, he says, "My manner of life from my youth, which was at the first among mine own nation at Jerusalem, know all the Jews which knew me from the beginning, if they would testify that after the most straitest, or maybe you could say strictest, sect of our religion, I lived a Pharisee." So Paul was, now here he says it past tense, but I'm sorry, I forgot your name. Eric? Okay. As Eric said, he remained a Pharisee, and we can find proof of that if you need proof in Acts 23 and verse 6, where Paul is talking to the, I guess it was probably the Sanhedrin at this point, and he said, Paul, he perceived that some part of them were Sadducees and others were Pharisees. He said, "Men and brethren, I am a Pharisee." Am, present tense. "I am a Pharisee and the son of a Pharisee." And then he played the resurrection card, which got him off the hook. So, Paul was a Pharisee. That was a positive thing, I think. They were zealous. They were zealous for the law. That is, you know, that's one of the primary things. Because we read the New Testament where Jesus is constantly in conflict with them, I think we all tend to have a negative impression of the Pharisees. Well, they weren't all evil, you know, and their motivation was not necessarily always wrong. They were trying to obey the law. Problem was, and Jesus is going to point it out in this parable, the problem was how they went about it and what they thought they could accomplish by that. And many other problems, and not the only thing. So, yes, Pharisees zealous for the law, but misguided in some ways, and the other adjectives that you used. How about a tax collector? A tax collector is pretty simple. A person who collects taxes. So we have a Pharisee, we have a tax collector. Now, can anybody give me a description or adjectives that describe tax collectors at that time? Their IRS or whatever, yes. Not well liked at all. I don't know what we would compare that to. We used to say used car salesman, but I've never really disliked a used car salesman, but I don't know who we dislike in our society. Any suggestions? But
IRS.
IRS, well, okay. I have my own business, so, yeah. they were disliked. They were, really looked down on. Any other descriptions of tax collectors? Yes. Some of them were dishonest. How was that? How did that happen? In what way did that express itself? In what way did anybody know? How did that express itself? It was either him. Was it him or John? It's in Luke. Luke 3. Yeah, did I write that wrong? Verse 12. Yeah, this was John, though, wasn't it? Yeah, it doesn't matter. Still the point. And yeah, it's verse 13, he said, they said, "What should we do?" And he said to them, "Exact no more than that which is appointed of you." Who said that? It was John. Okay, thank you. But Jesus would have said the same thing, I guess. You know, so why, and how could they, so that, what were they doing? What was the scam? The Romans said, for example, if it was a per capita tax like we have in, used to have in my township in Pennsylvania, we need to have so many dollars per head. All right? And it was up to the tax collector to get it. Could he take some extra for expenses? Yeah, that was okay. That was allowed. How much extra? Ah, that's where some of the extortion came in. Right? That's the kind of stuff that happened. You know, they had to run, in a sense, they were running a business, and it was okay to take more than what you had to give to the Romans. That was understood. But they were extortioners. They took more than they needed to. Anybody else have comments about the tax collectors? Mm-hmm. So you didn't have to be dishonest and extortioner and so forth to be a tax collector. You could be an honest one. Another reason that they were looked down on by the Jews is that they were seen as collaborators with the Romans, which was not popular, especially among, you know, the more conservative groups of, not among the Sadducees necessarily, but among the Pharisees or the Essenes and Zealots and so forth. That was that, you know, you're cooperating with the enemy. You're sleeping with the enemy. This is bad. So they were despised, and they were often corrupt. But it's interesting, as Gary points out. We'll look at Matthew 18. We'll look at a couple of scriptures here. Matthew 18 and verse 17. What do you say? It's just an expression. You'd use the term tax collector, publican, in an expression to make a point because it was just understood that they were a certain way. Look at Matthew 18 verse 17. It's talking about if someone will not hear you, and you take an extra person, and you want to try to solve a dispute or an offense, and you take people and you take them to the church, and they won't hear you. How do you treat them? Verse 17 says, "Let him be unto you as a heathen man and a publican." So they're right there, they're right up there or down there, if you want to put it, with heathens. You know, the assumption here is that a tax collector is a Jew, but he's just all the way down the bottom of the category of Jews, and the next category down, he'd be a Gentile and a non-believer. That's how badly they were looked at. And Jesus, you know, Jesus used that as just a way of saying something. But as Gary pointed out, he didn't discriminate against tax collectors, as we know from many scriptures. It had to do with where their heart was and so forth. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus uses tax collectors in kind of a negative connotation. In Matthew chapter 9 is another one, I think. Matthew chapter 9, verse 10. He was at the house. There were many tax collectors and sinners came down and sat with him. So Jesus associated with these people. But how were they viewed? Well, the Pharisees saw it and they said to the disciples, "Why does your master eat with tax collectors and sinners?" That's how negatively they were viewed. And that's why this parable here is such a contrast. It's comparing this Pharisee, who's the ultra-righteous, and the tax collector, who is the exact opposite. He's the lowest of the low. One more level down, and he'd be a Gentile. Heathen. Pagan. But, you know, you can look at Mark chapter 2 and verse 14, and it says that Jesus called somebody to be one of his 12 disciples who was a tax collector. So, obviously, you can't paint it with a big, broad brush. But in Jewish society, there was a big, broad brush, and these guys were bad. So that sets up the tension in the parable, that you have a Pharisee and you have a tax collector. And there's tension right at the beginning, right in the first line of the parable. And they went up to pray. If you look at the commentaries, they can say different things about praying. I have my take on it. It's not just mine. And that's what I'm going to share with you, but if you disagree, that's fine too. It says they went up to the temple to pray. The temple was a place of public worship. Some people think, well, they went up to pray privately. But it was a place of public worship and public prayer. That being said, it's not to say that there weren't private prayers said at the same time. And that's what I believe. I would use this as evidence, again, in the book of Luke, if we look at Luke chapter 1, remember the whole story about John the Baptist's father and how he went deaf and, you know, all this type of thing. There's a whole story here about John the Baptist and his father. Well, if we look at Luke chapter 1 and verse 7, now Elizabeth had no children, and they were well stricken in years. Elizabeth would be John the Baptist's mother. And it came to pass that while he executed the priest's office before God in the order of his course, you remember they had a system where you had the choir directors, as I was just teaching the kids, and they had a certain period of time they had to serve in the temple. And then they all came in for Passover and the Feast of Tabernacles. As according to the custom of the priest's office, his lot was to burn incense when he went into the temple of the Lord. That's part of what you did. You had the sacrifice and the morning and evening sacrifice, and you had incense that was burned along with that. The whole multitude of the people were praying outside at the time of the incense. So this time, this particular time, around the time of the morning and evening sacrifice, which involved or included this burning of incense, was a time of prayer, which shouldn't be surprising. We have in the Psalms, you know, let this prayer as incense be like incense. It was symbolic from Old Testament times. I won't turn there, but if you want to write it down, if you're taking notes, Psalm 141 and verse 1 and 2. But notice, we're still here in Luke, it says, and when it says, there appeared unto him an angel of the Lord standing by the right side of the altar of incense, and when Zechariah saw him, he was troubled, and fear fell upon him. But the angel said to him, don't fear, for your prayer is heard. Well, I read through it, and I didn't notice that he actually prayed anything. It doesn't spell out that he did, does it? The understanding is there that at the time of incense, that's when you prayed. And whoever wrote this, Luke wrote it, or Luke was, you know, putting somebody else's documents together, however it was understood that you'd be praying at that time. And the angel said, Zacharias, we've heard your prayer. So this was a time of prayer. And it was a time of public prayer. There were all these public prayers being made, but it's understood that there was also an opportunity where you could pray something that was personal and private. Yeah, Mike.
His dad was saying there were courses also in Israel. There were men from each tribe of Israel that were at the temple. They would be praying at this time. There were also men in the local community that would be praying in their community at this time.
Okay. At the same time. That's okay, thank you. I didn't know that. So my take on this, and from history and from Scripture, is that it definitely is a time of public prayer, but it was also a time when individuals could, in addition to the public prayer that's going on, have something personal and private. Maybe not so private, because it seems that they prayed out loud, but they could pray something that had to do with them and not necessarily with their neighbor or the whole nation. Although in this parable you see that we'll have one individual who decided to pray something about his neighbor. Okay. Any comments, just, you know, anytime. Raise your hand. Shout it out. So in the first stanza, we have the two men went up to the temple to pray. It was a public time of prayer. It was a time of the incense, which pictured prayer. And we have a Pharisee and a tax collector, which sets up an instant tension in the story because these are very, very different kinds of people, at least on the face of it. Of course, the beauty of this parable and many other Jesus parables is that he's telling a story, right? And he just sucks everybody. And you can just picture this, right? You can picture Jesus telling a story. You got the Pharisee, and you got the publican, and you got the tax collector, and he's just got them eating out of his hand, right? He's telling a story. But in the end, what's he do? He flips it. Boom. It's not what you think. Jesus was a master at that. I wish I could tell a story like he could tell a story. But that's what he does here. That's why one of the reasons it's called inverted parallelism. There's other reasons too, but it there's a twist right in the middle. And we find out it's not what you thought. It's different. Jesus does that a lot, and it's interesting to read about it. Okay, we get to verse 11. It says the Pharisee, if I read it from the King James, it says, "The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself, 'God, I thank you that I'm not as other men are.'" And I've heard that explained, that the Pharisee was praying to himself, and the prayer got no higher than the ceiling, as we say. I don't think that's correct. There are different, you know, textual variations of this in the text and so forth. It all has to do with how you read the "thus" part and the "by himself." It's just as easily translated, in some translations it is, that he stood by himself and prayed. Not that he was praying to himself. Because he wasn't praying to himself, he's praying to God. And if we have the parallelism, you know, the story says, how did the Pharisees stand? And then you get to the tax collector, he stood somewhere. The story is told in a way that it's, what matters is where and how the individual was standing, not whether he was praying to himself or not. So I submit to you that the King James has got it muddled there, and that it's better understood that he stood off by himself. Which leads to a question. Why would the Pharisee stand apart? Didn't say he stood way off somewhere. It just said he stood by himself. Why would he stand apart? Why would this make sense that he would stand apart from other people? Hugh?
He didn't want to mingle with sinners.
Why? That's true. I think that's true. Gary said they saw themselves as separate. Right? They saw that because they were righteous, God gave them a whole set of laws and a whole set of purification rituals and all this kind of stuff. They were very careful. They're always criticizing Jesus and the disciples that they're not washing properly. They're not doing this properly. And like I told you before, when they went across the lake up there to where the demon-possessed people were on the other side, and that was basically mostly a heathen area. There's no indication in Scripture that the disciples got off the boat. It says Jesus did, but it doesn't say they did. If they were good Jews, they probably didn't. Because they're not going to go over there and get a chance of being contaminated. Not because necessarily the disciples had bad attitudes. It was just what they were taught from the time they were little kids. And it was like, you remember math, your math problems? It's like if A equals B and B equals C, then A equals C. What's that called? The transitive property of equality? There's a transitive property of purity, right? And Gary and Mike can correct me if I'm wrong, but if you're impure and you lean up against this wall and then you walk away and I come over here and lean up against the wall, I'm impure. Transitive property of impurity. It's right in the Mishnah. No, I'm just kidding. They don't say it that way, but that's true. I would be impure. So why did he stand off by himself? Why does this make a good story? Well, as long as he's not touching anybody or leaning against the wall somewhere, he's going to stay just as pure as he was when he walked in there. Maybe that's why. You know, we're saying it's a story. It could be something that Jesus actually observed when he was in the temple. It's not out of the realm of possibility for sure. I would say, you know, but if you have that approach, I am so pure I can't even lean against the wall because who knows who's been there and that type of thing. If that's the way you're taught from the time you're a child, is that going to affect your attitude, the way you look at other people? We'll talk more about that later. I think it does. Okay. So I'm saying, I submit, and I could show you a couple translations that say it this way, that the Pharisee stood by himself and prayed. Not that he was praying to himself. Whether or not he was or wasn't, I don't think it matters. He was praying. He says he's praying to God. He says, "God, I thank you that I'm not like other men." So here's a Thanksgiving sermon, right? We always talk about what to be thankful for. Well, this one, you got one today that's telling you that here's somebody who's thankful, but he's put in a bad light. That God's actually telling you, here's something not to be thankful for. Don't be this way. He says, "I thank you that I am not like other men." You think anybody ever prayed that? I think so. I've known people that kind of acted that way. I don't know what they prayed in their private prayers. I've been that way a little bit myself. Maybe a lot. I've been a lot of ways that are in this parable. I don't know that I actually ever said, "I'm thankful that I'm not like other men," but I've said similar things. This parable hits home. In the second part of that verse, it says, even like this tax collector. I think in the King James it says, or, there's an or in there, or even like the publican, like it's different. Again, I will submit to you that or is not the best word there. I think that the Pharisee saying, look, these other people, they're extortioners, unjust, adulterers, like this tax collector. He's obviously an extortioner and unjust because he's a tax collector. And we might as well just throw an adulterer for good measure while we're being negative. What did he mean by that? I don't know. Maybe cooperating with the Romans. Even like this tax collector. This tax collector, he's one of the bunch. I'm so glad I'm not like him. Thank you, God. So what do we do? Maybe you've never done this. I hope not. But, you know, I have. It's like, oh, God, I'm so thankful I'm not like, you know, not that I fill in the blank. Say, I'm so thankful I'm not like Rick. No, I don't say that. But, you know, we say things. We say things, don't we? Yeah. We say, there but for the grace of God, so I. And that makes us sound righteous. I don't think it's in the Bible, right? But we say that. It makes, oh, we're so thankful to God that we're not like other people. Well, it's okay to say that. I'm not saying that's a wrong thing to say and a wrong attitude. Be thankful that we're not in another situation. We need to be careful about what attitude we carry that thanks with. Obviously, in this parable, Jesus is saying this guy said it with a totally wrong attitude. So be careful. You say, there, but for the grace of God, go I. What do you might be just saying, you know, looking for an attaboy or an attagirl, you're thanking God that you're so good. That's what we have to watch for. So the point here is not, I don't think, you can decide for yourself. I don't think the point was that we have this whole temple court full of extortioners, unjust adulterers. The point is the tax collector. He is an extortioner. He's unjust. He's an adulterer. He's the lowest of the low. And boy, am I glad I'm not like him. Because they're all in the court there. They can see each other. So Jesus, again, is painting this picture that includes some tension between these two individuals. Then we come to the climax, the center. I didn't tell you about this. Two go up, two go down, right? Pharisee, tax collector go up. It's mentioned in that order. You know what's interesting? When they come down, and we'll get there, it mentions them in the opposite order. This, I'm just going to illustrate the parallelism. I didn't do it at the time. This stanza, Pharisee stood by himself praying, thank you that I'm not like other men. Pharisee, his manner, this is where he stood and how he was. This is what he said. You come down here to the corresponding verse, stanza, whatever you want to call it. But it says, we'll get there, you know, that the tax collector beat on his chest saying, be merciful to me. That's the tax collector's manner in his prayer. So that's where you get the parallelism. Same thing. Tax collector image. The image of the tax collector is right here. This is what this guy is. He's unjust. He's evil. Thank God I'm not like him. Oh, boy, what could be worse? And here is the reality. He wouldn't even lift his eyes up to heaven. He stood apart from everybody. He was humble. That's the reality of what was going on with that individual. You know, the Pharisee, if you can think for him perhaps, he's thinking, one of the guys over there, he doesn't deserve to be with us. That's exactly what the tax collector thought. So that's, again, that's why I put this here. That's the parallelism. Well, now we're in the middle. There's no parallel to this. This is the climax. This is where the parable takes a turn. And it's usually the most important part, or the most important point of the parable. What does the Pharisee say? I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I get. That's not the way it says King James. I think it's King James says, I give tithes of all I have, maybe. All I possess. That could be translated, correct me if I'm wrong, Gary, that of all I get, all I obtain. Now, why? What strikes you about this? Anybody comments about the climax here? What's this telling you? Or how do you interpret this? You?
Counting on his works.
Okay, definitely counting on his works. Anything specific about the idea, the things he mentions there? Did God command fasting twice a week? Lucky for us, no. They didn't fast off 24 hours, did they? That was just a daytime fast, or was it 20? They didn't fast 24 hours. We don't know. Mike doesn't know. The point is, God said, fast on the Day of Atonement. Jesus had taught, well, when I'm gone, my disciples will fast. But there was no indication that you need to fast twice a week. But this guy was fasting twice a week, and that was going to be a badge of honor and obedience. He'd go above and beyond. Even more than what God asked for. Have you ever done that and had an attitude about it? I have. I'm different. I'm special. I follow the... You can hear it now. I could, from different churches. We follow the full counsel of God instead of the partial counsel of God. We have it... We've rolled the clock back to 19, fill in the blank, which whatever date you want. We're better than some other, I've done that. I'm not a Laodicean. They sound bad in Revelation. I go above and beyond what God asks for. How about give tithes of all that I possess or all that I obtain or get? Literally, does God say tithe everything? Mike? Okay, well, this could be, I guess you could say increases what he obtains. Yeah.
The understanding I have, even the present day, is they only tithe in I think it's in Deuteronomy, I'm not sure what chapter verse, but it's, I believe it's 8, it might be 7 things, the barley, the wheat, the olives, the dates, which would be translated honey in the King James, I don't remember the other ones.
Okay.
Right.
So, at least in practice, they did not tithe on every single thing. And when they wanted to be, someone said, well, I tithe the mint and anise and cumin. It wasn't required. I'm extra good. This guy tithes on everything. That wouldn't be wrong, but it's not something to be proud of. He trusted, as you said, trusted in his own form of obedience. Maybe, if I could say it this way, did he trust? This is the kind of thing that hits home with me. Did he trust in being right? He knew he was right. Is it wrong to know you're right? How does that sound? Well, I think we should know. We should try hard to be right. But it can't be a point of vanity or self or standing with God. And with him, it was. So there's a line there. You don't want to be wrong. Say, there's this. Have you ever seen people? I'm not asked for show of hands, but people that are kind of like sinners and proud of it, because God's so merciful and graceful, and other, I can never go to church over there. You got to be really good to go over there, I've heard people say that kind of stuff. That friend is looking for a church where he wouldn't be so judgmental. What did he mean by that? Well, I know what he meant by that. I won't go into details, but it's because of something he wanted to do that was not. The Bible didn't approve of. He had to find a church that wasn't judgmental so that he could not be judged for what he was doing that God said is wrong. So that's one extreme. And then the other extreme is, obviously, I'm righteous. I'm doing all these things like the Pharisee here. I'm so righteous. Paul said, don't sin so grace abounds. So that would be another ditch to be in. So I don't know if any of this rings a bell for you or hits close to home, but it does for me. Both now and especially in my past, we'll get to that a little later before I make a comment on that. Okay, where are we? We're at verse 12, maybe, or so. The tax collector, maybe it's 13, stood afar off. He wasn't just standing by himself in the sense of not wanting to touch anybody. He stood so far away that it indicated that he didn't feel like he deserved to be with the others, right? Isn't that what you get from it? I don't deserve it. He wouldn't even lift up his eyes to heaven. Any comments about this section or how the inverted parallelism compares to the Pharisee and his manner? Any comments? Okay, yeah. Difference between the attitudes, for sure. He was humble. The tax collector was humble. Anybody else? That's the comparison that Jesus is making here. Big difference between their approach. And it says he smote his breast, or chest, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. He smote his chest. I read somewhere, maybe somebody knows something about this, I don't, I just know what I read, that this this pose or position or stature is something that is, and head down, would be an accepted accepted posture to have during public prayer in the temple, something like this. Maybe hand, or maybe like this, I don't know, crossed in some way, head down. Somebody wrote that. This guy, if that's, if anybody, you know, if, yeah, go ahead. Oh, they would actually hit their chest. And that's, well, that's the, what happens here. It's like, if this is the position, let's, you know, take it as a point of argument, I guess. If this is the position, he couldn't keep his hands still. He had to do this. Maybe he felt it was, you know, part of the tradition at the time and customs, and we could actually look at later on in the book of Luke, I think it's chapter 23. Did I write it down? Yeah. Verse 46. This is after Jesus died. And verse 47 says, the centurion said, this is certainly a righteous man. And verse 48 says, the people that came together in that sight, beholding the things which were done, smote their breasts and returned. So they were doing this. Why is he doing it? I don't know. Maybe he was just so nervous and filled with emotion that he couldn't keep his hands still. I don't know. Go ahead. Mike was first. Oh, okay, yeah. Okay, instead of sticking it out, he was beating on it. Yeah, Eric. Right, grief. Which, obviously, yeah, from the crucifixion there. Okay, thank you. So he's in a state of grief. The other one's in a state of pride, or whatever else you want to call it. So, obviously, we keep getting this contrast here. And he says, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. That's King James. Anybody have a different translation there? I think most of the translations are similar. I read that it could be translated. I don't know if it's just a different text or just a different translation because of the word that's used that's translated mercy there, which usually is translated mercy. It could be conceivable to translate it, make an atonement for me. Make an atonement for me. Now, I don't know. I'm not a translator or a textual critic, but that makes sense to me because what is the time? The time is he was there either at the morning or the evening sacrifice, you know, at dawn or about 3 PM when they are going to sacrifice a lamb and then they take, you know, parts of the lamb and they put it on the incense altar. They got the incense altar and they got different parts that they're taking different places. And the whole purpose of that is for what? Atonement for the people of Israel. Twice a day. And this guy, who's lowest of the low, looked down on by everyone, including this Pharisee over here, is feeling so down about who he is and what he is that he can't even stand with the rest of the people. And he's off to the side, and he's beating himself in the chest, showing grief, as Eric says. And he wishes inside that atonement that's going on, symbolized there in the temple by this animal being sacrificed in the altar of incense. He wishes that that could apply to him, too. But he knows that the people in charge do not apply it to him. And one of the guys who's a big shot is right over there, out loud, saying, I'm glad I'm not like that tax collector over there. Did Jesus ever see this actually happen? Well, we don't know, but we can ask later. I think maybe he did. And it burned him up. So, the tax collectors just wished that atonement could apply to him. Because in his world, all the messages said, it doesn't. You're evil. You're dirt. Lowest of the low. That Pharisee didn't, it wasn't very likely that the Pharisee in this story thought that the atonement being acted out in the temple was applicable to the tax collector. I don't think that's what he thought. You've got the altar there. You've got this temple, this big, you know, building, and you've got an altar outside. And they killed the lamb there. You know, and they're burning the flesh. And a smell, yeah, it's a smell. It's a good smell. Sweet savor, God calls it. And you've got the incense burning. You probably smell that too. You've got all this going on. You've got a priest you've got public prayers happening. You've got, did they have a choir every day? They had the choir. They had people singing. They had the choir director. Chris just came back, right? Christopher and who's there? Ryan. You know, we had that choir director. And they had trumpets and they had all these different instruments. Atonement for the people. You had the priest come out and give the benediction, you know, the blessing on the people. You had all this stuff going on. And this tax collector just wished that he wanted it to apply to him. He's smelling the smells. He's hearing all the sounds. He's seeing. It must have been, you know, I've never been there. It must have been almost a sensory overload to be there. And the temple was an imposing building. The one Herod built. And he stands off to the side, humbly asking God that this, all this is going on, could it just apply to me too? Because the message he's been hearing all his life is that it doesn't apply to people like him. And then we get the answer. Jesus says, I tell you, he, talking about the tax collector, he went down to his house justified, made right. Rather than that one. Now he's referring to it as that one, you know, the first one. So he was justified. And then we get the summary, because he that exalts himself will be abased, and he that humbles himself shall be exalted. I think that's an addition. It doesn't fit the parallelism of the parable. So it's a conclusion, just like the introduction was an introduction. Okay. So that's, you know, a very quick run-through of the parable, maybe an analysis. Let's just brainstorm a little bit. While you're waiting for the turkey to get fully cooked or whatever's going on in there. Let's brainstorm. I led up to this sermon by saying, look, the Bible actually tells us not only a whole lot of things to be thankful for, but at least in one instance, tells us something to not be thankful for. This parable makes it clear that we are not to be thankful like this guy was thankful. Not to be thankful that we're not like other men, that we're extortioners, unjust, adulterers, and so on and so forth. And to have that attitude. Would we, if you will humor me now, let's talk, give me some adjectives or some descriptions of the Pharisee. Things that we should not, perhaps we should not be. You know, we know a lot of, there are some good qualities of Pharisees, but this parable is not talking about them. Give me some in this story, give me some descriptions, some adjectives or whatever of the Pharisee. Self-righteous. Okay, go ahead. Anybody else? Sorry?
Judgmental.
Okay. Doesn't have another E in it, does it? I don't know.
He was confident in his relationship with God, although he didn't have the relationship that he assumed.
Confident.
Overconfident.
I'll just say overconfident. Okay. Didn't have the relationship he thought he did. Anything else? Sorry? Okay. Can't find one word for that, can we?
Unrepentant.
Okay. Thank you. I'm getting tired. Okay, write all this. A-E. Unrepentant. E? A. Anybody know? I used to know how to spell when I was younger. Anything else? Oh, okay. This is a list of things not to be. John. Okay. Thought he was better. What's the word for that? Can I say it this way? Can I say condescending? Does that cover it in one word? I had a word. The first word that came to my mind, you all haven't even said, but it includes a lot of these things. Kind of includes this one here. Yes? Unloving. Proud. Getting back to all these bad things. First one that came to my mind was smug. Maybe that's the overconfident. Don't you think he was smug? That includes a lot of things. He's confident in his relationship. He thinks he's right. Now, some of these hit close to home because, you know, I don't know about you, but I've been these things. Hopefully I'm not too much anymore. I think back, my wife's mother has been going a long time, and I said, you know, you think you know it all. You're self-righteous. You're not. Anything else? I got another one here. It's one that my mother-in-law called me, I think. Did you have? Ritualistic. Okay. Sorry, this is hiding from some of you here. I'll get rid of this before you have to play, Rick. Ritualistic, or what's the word for that when you trust in ritual to legalistic. Yeah. There's a word for that. I can't think of it now. My wife and my mother-in-law said that when I was more like this than I am now, hopefully I'm a little less now, that I was not empathetic. Unempathetic, not sympathetic, whatever you want to say. Lacking compassion, yes. That's exactly the words they were using, my mother-in-law. She was right. I didn't know it at the time. It used to be worse, yeah. Okay. Now, if just the last exercise I want to go through here, what kind of problems do these things cause in terms of trying to live? You know, obviously they are problems in their own right. Right? These are bad things. We made a list of bad things. What problems do they lead to? What complications do they lead to in our lives? These types of attitudes or these types of approaches. What? How do they give us difficulty in doing something that we should do? Yes, Rita. Okay. I don't know where to write all this stuff, but people will not listen. Anything else? Okay. Bad relationships. Arlene, you said something?
People don't like someone that's quality.
Okay. That's kind of like they won't listen to you. Bad relationships. Unliked, whatever. Anything else? Yes. I'm sorry, I can't hear too well. Bad. Oh, you can't. Oh, okay. Wow. Yeah. Is that what you're saying? Bad mentor. Good point. What's our job as Christians? Be a light, edify. So,
In terms of an actual thing to do, to accomplish. Love one another. That's, all these things are things we're to do. But what is our job, our commission? Use that word. Teach, make disciples. Do these attitudes or characteristics, do they lend themselves to making disciples of other people? Do people look at me and see all this and go, sign me up. I want to be like you. No, Mike? Maybe God works with us in spite of that.
But there's a need for people to be in organizations like that now because they're still there.
Oh, okay. I wasn't necessarily going to make that point one way or the other. These are bad qualities to have. But if the fact that somebody has any of those qualities does not necessarily make them un-Christian. It's just something that God will, if you have it or I have it, God will get it out of us sooner or later. And if a whole organization has it, God'll deal with that too. I'm not trying to knock any particular group of people. Just saying that in my opinion, and I think some of you would agree anyway, most of you, that if I come across as smug and unloving and proud, I don't think I'm going to lead people to Christ with that attitude. I might scare people to Christ, but I'm not going to lead people to Christ. Yeah, I could scare people away. Go ahead. Yes. Okay. Yeah. So, there's nobody. This is a characterization. We hope that there wasn't any one person in Jesus' life and ministry that was all of these things that we're describing. Maybe there was. But he's making a point by telling the story. I'm about ready to wrap up. Anybody have something else they want to say before I do? How can we... Oh, I'm sorry, Bonnie.
It appears to me that Pharisee overall is a human being, we're all human beings.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't say anything in the parable that Christ would correct him in any way. That man is going to go on believing that he's doing the right thing because...
God has to open the mind for any one of us. This obviously is making one point. He's not trying to cover the spectrum of all possible, occurrences. But Jesus, it says in the introduction that Jesus was giving this parable to people who thought they were justified by, what they were doing, and he despised others. So you do have examples in the Gospels of Jesus telling people exactly that this isn't the right kind of attitude to have. Now, whether they heard him or didn't, some did, some didn't. I mean, it's just like now. But God has opened your minds. We are proceeding on the assumption here, of course, that we have had our minds open, and to whatever extent these attitudes are still in us, we want to get rid of them. But yeah, definitely, people are deceived. We are deceived to a certain extent too. How do we know? Well, we ask God to remove those blinders, the deception. To remove, there's a God of this world that deceives the minds. Yes.
Becoming leaders. Now, if you stay-
stay under authority indefinitely, you never learn to make decisions.
Yeah, I think we're all under authority, but we definitely have to also be in a position to where we make choices and decisions. I mean, we're all obviously under God's authority and so on, and lots of different authority, but I agree with you absolutely. We can't always be taking direction, and somehow or another, God's going to flip a switch, and I don't, I guess he could do whatever he wants, but it doesn't seem to be his style to flip a switch, and all of a sudden we will know how to give direction. There has to be supposedly this is a learning curve. Mike and Gary, had your hands. Mm-hmm. Okay, and I wasn't trying to even go in that direction necessarily and make any points, but points are well taken. You had your hand up?
Yeah, I did. It's interesting, in the summary statement in the end of verse 14, the word that Greek that's used to translate exalt, sometimes like an AJP, it really connotes putting yourself up on high. So if you look at what you put up on the board, placing himself up on high, both by his actions and words, what he displayed behind his actions and words, his attitude, where versus the publican or the tax collector was actually humbling himself. And so, and if I remember correctly, the Greek here, humbled is almost like, I'll have to look it up, but the word for fasting, almost kind of that humility.
Mm-hmm. And there's always going, thank you, there are always going to be people that we are under authority to, whether it's IRS, like she mentions, or, you know, there's always somebody that we're under authority of, and many of them are going to be this way. We hope not, but it's part of the human experience that we have to live with, for sure. Eric, go ahead. Mm-hmm. My guess is, like Bonnie said, you know, he, like all of us, to one extent or another, but he's deceived. He could probably, as I've used the expression, he could probably give the sermon on humility and how it ought to be. And he could quote all the scriptures, and he knows it. But for some reason or another, he doesn't practice it, at least in certain areas of his life, the public worship that Jesus is talking about here. But absolutely he should know, and probably did, and probably, you know, could quote the scriptures and give the sermon. I agree with you. You should know. It's all there. It's not a New Testament concept. It's an Old Testament concept. Anybody else? Oh, well, thanks for your participation. I believe the parable's written for us. It's not written. The whole point of the parable is not that we should read this and apply it to somebody else. Say, yeah, I'm glad that's there because this person needs it. You know, that's exactly what the parable is teaching us not to do. Each of us needs to be constantly aware of our absolute dependence on God and on the atoning sacrifice of His Son. And next time, I want to stay in Luke because there's some other things I want to talk about. Actually, one other. I'm not going to tell you which one. I'm going to talk about another parable in Luke's Gospel next time I get to speak. And it also draws a picture, a very interesting picture that's similar to this in that there's a sharp contrast between one individual and another individual. And it's just so amazing the way Jesus just flips it right in the middle. So that'll be next time.